Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, talking about Alfred Hitchcock in London. I've done a bit of writing about film and a bit of lecturing, and I guide several different walks to do with film subjects. And inevitably, Hitchcock crops up time and time again. He's a huge figure in cinema, remains so. It's 40 years ago, it seems to have gone in the blink of an eye, but I remember reading the news headlines at the end of April, 1980 it would have been, when Hitchcock died. And 40 years have passed, and he is still one of the most easily recognisable and one of the most influential filmmakers that any country produced. And he was one of the most quintessentially English of film directors. And this might sound surprising in a way. Hitchcock might have spent half his life based in the United States. He might have become an American citizen. He might have had his own syndicated American TV series that was hugely successful. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and later the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. He did all these things based in the US. He moved into widescreen, VistaVision, Technicolor. He had the biggest studio resources and the biggest stars in the galaxy of Hollywood in his movies. But he remained, to the end of his days, quintessentially English. And the English influences on his work were extraordinary. They continued right the way through his career, often cropping up in rather odd places, which I'll come to, I hope, at some point during this little chat. Alfred Hitchcock was born on the 13th of August, 1899, and he was born in the family home above their shop in Leytonstone, in the East End. The address was 517 The High Road, Leytonstone. And before you get onto your Google Maps or plan a visit there, be prepared to be a little bit disappointed because their house doesn't survive anymore. There's a petrol station there, in fact, which has a plaque to Hitchcock on it. So he's not forgotten there. Leytonstone Underground Station, by the way, is worth a look because it has a wonderful series of murals about Hitchcock and his work. A lovely tribute to a local boy made good. His father died when he was 15 years old, shortly after the start of the First World War in 1914. And Hitchcock needed to work, and he found an office job at the Henley Telegraph and Cable Company out near Liverpool Street Station in the City of London. They were involved in producing communications equipment that ran through the trenches and so on. And Hitchcock went to work for them at 15 shillings a week, calculating the sizes and voltage of electric cables. In his spare time, young Hitchcock was attending art college as well. And he used his artistic skill eventually to work in Henley's advertising department. As a young man, he goes to the theatre and goes to films. And he reads film magazines, not the fan magazines, but the trade journals, the technical stuff. He gets very interested in that. He said in interviews years later that as a child he was fascinated by maps and timetables. And that's one of the reasons that when he deals with London in his films, you often get tiny details that are completely irrelevant to, you know, an audience watching it in Nebraska or Melbourne or anywhere in the world. And to be honest, these are details that are largely irrelevant to most people in London unless they know very specific things or happen to be familiar with a particular bus route and that kind of thing. But you often get meticulous detail in Hitchcock's films. And that background love of maps and timetables obviously feeds into that, I think. Just after the First World War, an American company, a film company, Famous Players Lasky, was opening a studio in London. They'd taken on an old power station in Islington, which is in North London. And eventually they pulled out and it was taken over by a consortium of British investors. But not before Hitchcock had sent in a little portfolio of drawings and had been taken on in the studio by the titles department. And he is one of those people when he becomes a director, who goes into directing film with an incredible knowledge of most aspects of it, an overview which a lot of directors understandably don't have. But Hitchcock had worked on designing title cards and the intertitle cards for silent movies. He worked on set design. He got to know the script writers in a tiny studio, comparatively, that the studio in Islington was. It was quite easy to sort of wander down the corridor and have a look at people editing stuff. It was quite easy to wander along and see where the costumes were being designed and so on. And you get a much fuller picture, as he did, of all the processes and how they all feed into one. And that's something that remained with him. When the studio was being rented out after the American company had gone, various British productions went into it. And there was a very famous, greatly loved, chiefly theatre producer and actor by the name of Seymour Hicks, Sir Seymour Hicks, as he eventually becomes. And he was making a movie, and he had a falling out with the director, and Hitchcock joined him in finishing the film. And that was Hitchcock's first bite at being an assistant director to this very, very famous man, Seymour Hicks, and they finished the film together. And half of the film survives. It's called Always Tell Your Wife. And unfortunately, we don't know which bit Hitchcock worked on, if any of the footage that he was responsible for is in it. But it occasionally pops up in retrospectives and you know, the British Film Institute and so on. It's well worth a look, along with a lot of this early stuff that Hitchcock was learning on. Because eventually, a consortium comes into the old Power Station studio, headed up by Michael Balkan, and it becomes, very famously, Gainsborough Film Studios. If you've ever seen a Gainsborough picture, you will have seen the Gainsborough lady in her big hat inclining out of the picture frame towards the camera at the beginning of all their productions. And Michael Balkan put Hitchcock to work with a man called Graham Cutts. And Graham Cutts was one of the star directors at Gainsborough in the mid-1920s, no question about that. And Hitchcock was his assistant director on five pictures made over a period of a couple of years. And there's a couple of them that survive complete and half of another and so on. And it's during that period, by the way, that Hitchcock is suddenly, as a fully-fledged assistant director, he's on the same pay scale as somebody else who's been in the film industry longer than him. And that's Alma Revel, who works as a scriptwriter and an editor. And she eventually becomes Mrs. Hitchcock, as some of you probably know. And if you've seen that wonderful, slightly fanciful film, Hitchcock, with Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren, a kind of fantasy around the making of Psycho. It's a wonderful film, partly because the cast are sublime, all of them, everybody who's in it is amazing, but partly because Hopkins and Mirren show us Hitch and Alma for once, and Alma is given the equal status that she had. And it's a really important thing, because Hitchcock wasn't just this individual. He and Alma were an absolute partnership from then onwards, really, from the time they started working on films together in 1923. They were absolutely inseparable. She often spots things that other people miss. She's often the person who Hitchcock turns to for approval of scripts that have been written. Thinking about Psycho, actually, Joseph Stefano, who wrote the script for that, said a number of times in interviews that Hitchcock would never say anything when they had script meetings. Hitchcock was not lavish with his praise for his technicians and writers and actors. But he would always say, well, you know, if there's a problem, I'll let you know. But otherwise, I've asked you to do the job and I assume you can do it. But Joseph Stefano remembered that if he'd written a scene and you know, left it with Mr. Hitchcock and come back for a script meeting the following day, he knew that he'd hit the nail on the head if Hitchcock said, Alma really liked that scene you wrote. In other words, it had passed the acid test, because Alma had said it was okay, so it obviously was. And they're working together with Graham Cutts in the mid-1920s on five successive films, as I say, and it's after that that Hitchcock becomes a fully-fledged director. Michael Balcom gives him a chance to direct on his own. So it's a gradual process. Hitchcock later said he didn't have any ambitions when he started out to become a film director. It was something that gradually evolved for him. And the first two films he makes as a director aren't shot in London. They're shot in studios in Munich, locations in Italy and in Austria, actually. But it's his third film that is his first film shot in London. And it's the first of the films with London locations that I wanted to talk about. And it's The Lodger. The Lodger has been filmed a number of times. It's been adapted for stage. And the original novel was published before the First World War by Mrs. Belloc Lowndes, who was a prominent figure, actually, among women writers in the suffrage movement. And The Lodger, as Hitchcock made it, is really the first Hitchcock film, in the sense that, with hindsight, if you think what ingredients there often are in a Hitchcock film, you'll say, well, suspense, and lots of it. Sometimes a murder, sometimes several murders. Sometimes an innocent man on the run. Quite often there'll be a heroine who falls in love with this innocent man on the run, and that heroine will quite often be blonde. Quite often there's another man who might be an ineffectual policeman or authority figure, but who's not going to get the girl at the end. There'll be character parts for a little bit of comic relief. There'll probably be some kind of pursuit where the hero, and sometimes the heroine, are in terrible danger. And all these ingredients, the pursuit, the innocent man on the run, all these elements, the blonde heroine, the ineffectual policeman, who's the heroine's boyfriend at the start of the film, but he's soon ditched. They're all there in The Lodger. And The Lodger is quite subtle in its use of locations. It has some very vivid images as news of one of a series of murders is passed around over the airwaves and via newsprint. And there's location footage of Shaftesbury Avenue, actually, which you can spot from the theatres as they go past, where the newspaper van is hurtling through the streets with the news of the latest murder by the Avenger, who leaves this triangular design on a piece of paper on his victims' bodies. And the opening of that film is amazing. It's pure silent cinema at its best. And this is from Hitchcock, who, when he made it, was 26 years old, and it's only his third feature as a director, and it's incredibly confident. And the star of the film was Ivan Avello. And Ivan Avello today isn't, to the general public, one of the great British movie stars, partly because he got into the early 1930s, and he pretty much gave up making films entirely to concentrate on writing and appearing in his wonderful series of musicals. Incidentally, Novello never sang in his productions. He'd been a champion choir boy, and of course he became a composer. But when his voice broke, he didn't have any kind of assistance to continue to develop a singing voice of his own, and never had any confidence in it. He used to say in interviews, you know, when this subject was raised, he would say, well, I always think it's much better that after the show, people say, Ivor, why don't you sing in your shows? I think that's much better than if they come up to me afterwards and say, Ivor, why do you sing in your shows? And so when he appeared in his own productions, which he often did, he played the piano or was a composer or somebody who had an excuse for being there and being part of the music without actually having to sing. And that's what Novello is best remembered for. He writes the music to keep the home fires burning. We'll gather lilacs. I can give you the starlight and so on. He's wonderful, wonderful composer. But in the 1920s, he becomes one of the great stars, particularly of silent cinema in Britain. And it's partly because he has a very, very sharp and elegant profile. It's not unlike the great American actor John Barrymore. And Novello had dark eyes, which photograph much better and much more warmly under the heavy studio lights. And he had a mane of dark hair. And so he is a classic, handsome, romantic matinee idol type. And in Hitchcock's version of The Lodger, there was no way that he was going to be guilty. So a lot of the movie is spent building up the idea that this man who's moved in, this mysterious stranger, who's often out when there's a murder and often out at odd hours at night, that he may or may not be the Avenger, the serial killer. Well, he isn't. He's trying to track down the Avenger because the Avenger killed his sister. But it's a very compelling, slightly otherworldly performance from Novello. And there's one of the murders that takes place in The Lodger. And it's not staged in a very obvious way. But if you look closely at the sequence, you'll see that it was really filmed, the run-up to the murder, on location outside the Houses of Parliament. The victim and her boyfriend have a tiff, and he walks off and leaves her. And in fact, they're standing close to the statue of Oliver Cromwell, which you may have seen just across the road from Westminster Abbey, outside Westminster Hall. And obviously the security arrangements today mean it looks a little different, and the walls and fencing and so on have changed a bit. The actual murder itself is supposedly taking place close to there, but that's filmed on part of a studio set. And I wonder if that use of Parliament, without sort of the iconic clock of Big Ben and so on, without that being part of the sequence, but I wonder if that plants a bit of an idea which Hitchcock comes back to later, which is the notion that you can stage a terribly dramatic, possibly lethal event in a major public building or a great landmark. I'll come back to that in a minute. When The Lodger is eventually released, and the studio seemed to have havered over that a little bit, because Hitchcock had worked not just in Munich, but he'd also done some work as an assistant director at the UFA studios outside Berlin, which are the biggest studios in Europe at the time. So there's quite a lot of German expressionism in The Lodger, in the camera angles and the lighting and so on. It was something that's certainly very different from the surviving material that Graham Cutts was producing at the same period, for example. It seems much more avant-garde. And that's probably why it became more successful and has endured more. And if you've not seen it and you're tempted to track it down, do try and get, I'm not on commission from them, but do try and get the British Film Institute's restoration of The Lodger, which they did a few years ago when they were doing wonderful work on restoring all of Hitchcock's silent films to as complete and cleaned prints as they could. And their restoration of The Lodger is phenomenal, and you can get that on DVD and Blu-ray. It probably looks better than it did to most of the original cinema audiences, I suspect. But the film, when it was eventually released, was a big success. And it was followed up by a much less well-known Hitchcock film, which reunited him with Novello as star, and it's called Downhill, which charts the progress of a young man whose life goes steadily downhill when he takes the blame for something he hasn't done. And there's not a lot in London in that film, although there is a wonderful sequence where Roddy, played by Novello, finally returns home at the end of the movie, and there's some lovely location footage heading northwards over London Bridge into the city, and then some shots of Piccadilly Circus. But Downhill was originally a play that was on at a couple of theatres. It was on at the Queen's Theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue and the Prince's Theatre. And if you look that up today, you'll find that it's what we now call the Shaftesbury Theatre, right at the far end, the sort of east end of Shaftesbury Avenue, where it sort of vanishes in a mixture of streets where they all crisscross each other and everybody gets lost, even with their apps today. And it had been on stage, and Novello had co-written the play. And when they did the original screenings of it in London, Novello appeared in person. Now, I know you're probably used to the idea of movie premieres, the stars are there on the red carpet, the endless selfies and so on. But this was something a little bit different, because The opening reel of Downhill is a very busy one in terms of numbers because it begins with a rugby match at the public school that Roddy goes to and a dinner afterwards. And so it's very busy, lots of location footage and large numbers of people. And the sort of key turning point a little bit later on in the movie is a scene between Roddy and his friend Tim, where they have a discussion in their dormitory, in their room, and they're then summoned to the headmaster's office for this fateful meeting where Roddy will take the blame for what Tim has done, protecting his friend at the ruin of his career. Well, when that was screened for, I think, the first week at the Plaza on Lower Regent Street, just down from Piccadilly Circus, the building is still there. There's a little cinema in the basement. The actual foyer of the Plaza is now a Tesco Metro supermarket, but the exterior of it looks exactly the same. It has a wonderful cupola on the corner, and it was purpose-built as a cinema only a couple of years before Downhill was screened there. And it was used for lots of movie premieres later on. But those early screenings, Novello and Robin Irvin, who played Tim, they appeared live on stage, acting out that scene. The early scenes are projected and the orchestra plays, and then the curtain goes up and there they are on stage to do the next scene. And after they've done that, the film picks up. And that's the most extraordinary thing. I first read about this in the best book about Hitchcock's early period that you're ever likely to read. It's Charles Barr's English Hitchcock, which is a masterwork. And I was just astonished reading that. And I sort of went and looked up the data about when it was performed and so on. And so, yes, if you'd been there in October 1927 at the Plaza, you wouldn't just have seen Mr. Novello in passing. You would have seen him acting out one of the scenes from the play slash film while you were watching the film. So there's a, I suppose, an original version of the film, in a sense, that's never going to be recreated, because you can't recreate it without the actors actually being there. But in the 1920s, Hitchcock dots around through lots of different genres as he's making films. He's not, despite the success of The Lodger, he's not geared towards thrillers, geared towards suspense. He adapts all kinds of things, including an original screenplay of his own, which is called The Ring, which is about boxers, in fact, two boxers. And the girl who starts the film in love with one of them is tempted away by the other and may or may not return to the much nicer chap who she started out with by the final reel. It's a really brilliant film. And for me, one of the best nights out at a movie that I ever went to was in 1999, when the British Film Institute were doing, for Hitchcock's centenary, for 100 years since he was born, they were doing a complete retrospective of absolutely everything they could get their hands on that he'd done. So the fragments of the films where he worked as an assistant director, most of his silent stuff. They had a screening of The Ring with a live performance of a new score. And if you know silent movie composers of the present day, you probably see where this is heading. But it was Neil Brand, the brilliant Neil Brand, and the musicians performing his score for The Ring. And it is quite one of the best things I've ever seen or heard. And one of the key things about The Ring, for the purposes of London on film and Hitchcock in London, is that the most significant boxing match in the movie, and there are several, is staged in the Albert Hall. So it's a trick pub question that somebody might ask. How many movies did Alfred Hitchcock stage a key event in the Royal Albert Hall? Well, Hitchcock fans automatically think of the two versions in 1934 and 1956 of The Man Who Knew Too Much, in which a key moment takes place at the Royal Albert Hall, where an assassination attempt is being made during a particular passage of the Storm Cloud Cantata. They're very different films, equally successful, equally brilliant, but very, very different. But they both use the Royal Albert Hall. But yes, the trick question is, how many films did Hitchcock use it? Well, it's certainly three, if you include The Ring. But he dots around, as I say, through lots of different genres. So he adapts a Noel Coward play, Easy Virtue. He adapts a very lovely, rustic, but very romantic and very funny stage comedy called The Farmer's Wife. That's one of Hitchcock's sort of unsung glories, wonderful film. He returns to the thriller genre in the most important film of his early career. And it's the most important film because it's the one that marks the crossover point from silent to sound. It's called Blackmail. And by this time, Hitchcock was with another studio, British International Pictures, who were based out at Elstree in Hertfordshire, north of London. And when it went into pre-production, Blackmail was slated as a silent film. But Hitchcock knew that Britain was about 18 months or thereabouts behind the States in terms of converting to sound, and he knew it was going to happen. And he planned very carefully with his first shooting block that he would have two usable takes of every shot, because in those days it was very difficult to duplicate from the camera negative without losing quality. So he's making sure he can assemble two distinct negatives. And sure enough, the studio say, oh, we're going to get some sound equipment. We'd like you to do some reshoots with sound. And Hitchcock had already planned which sequences would be dialogue, which would have effects and music put onto them. And the result is an amazing achievement for somebody grappling with a completely new medium. And it became a huge success. And there's a lot of location footage. At the beginning of the film, a police squad van is zipping through the streets and they receive a communication that they have to go and arrest a suspect, and off they go. And that's how we're introduced to the hero of the film, played by John Longdon, the policeman. At the end of the movie, the blackmailer is being chased by the police and the squad van is after him, and he jumps in a taxi and ends up at the British Museum. Now, those sequences of the squad van and then the squad van and the taxi, they don't make any sense at all, the way they're cut together. Most of the footage is from the Haymarket and Lower Regent Street, actually. In fact, you see the Plaza Cinema that I mentioned before, very, very briefly, in a couple of shots. And there's also footage of Kingsway, which runs up from Aldwych northwards. So there's all kinds of stuff being cut together as the suspect is being pursued. And why not? Because he eventually ends up at the British Museum, which is not that far from Kingsway. And the scene in the British Museum perhaps picks up on that notion that might have been planted in Hitchcock's mind when he set the murder near Parliament in the Lodger. Because the British Museum is used for the climax of the film, dramatically. The blackmailer is pursued by the police into the museum. He runs through the galleries. He eventually climbs onto the roof of what was then the reading room of the library part of the museum, and is now the museum's central court exhibition area, and he climbs up to the top. And I'm going to assume that not everybody has seen the movie, so I won't tell you how that sequence ends, if you forgive me. But it's an amazing film. And right in the middle is another great use of London locations. It comes at a point when the heroine is walking through London. Annie Andre's character, Alice, accepts an invitation by a rather elegant but slightly dodgy artist called Mr. Crewe to come back to his apartment, and he assaults her and she stabs him in self-defense and kills him and wanders through the streets. And there's footage of an almost deserted Charing Cross area at the top of Whitehall with Trafalgar Square in the background, and then footage of her walking around in the Piccadilly Circus area, although most of this is actually done on a studio set. In those days, on the side of the London Pavilion, which was a theatre and eventually a cinema and now a sort of flexible exhibition and retail space, on the side of the London Pavilion used to be a famous advert for Gordon's Gin, the heart of a good cocktail. And it showed a cocktail shaker. And as the lights changed in the late 1920s, the cocktail shaker would go up and down and up and down as though it was being shook. And we see Alice staring at this, and in her imagination, and visually, this is picked up in the movie, the cocktail shaker going up and down suddenly becomes a knife being stabbed up and down, up and down. And it's a bravura moment that takes something that was a familiar landmark to a lot of people and a lot of visitors to London and turns it into something that is very, very personal to the heroine. You know, if you thought in the Bridget Jones films, the Coca-Cola, was it? The Coca-Cola advert that kept saying, go, Bridget, go, or listing how many cigarettes she'd smoked that week or something. If you thought that was kind of, wow, they've used the signs at Piccadilly Circus. Well, it worked brilliantly in those movies. But it goes back to 1929 and to Hitchcock using it for a rather more serious purpose in Blackmail. I'm going to talk about just a couple of films very briefly, which are poles apart in time for Hitchcock, but they just give a sense of, I think, the meticulous detail that he could apply to the use of London. And one of them is The 39 Steps. Now, I happen to think The 39 Steps is an absolute masterpiece. It puts to shame a lot of much longer films by packing in so much into about an hour and 20 minutes, I think the running time is. It's got one of Robert Donat's greatest performances, that beautiful, mellifluously voiced actor playing Richard Hannay. And it begins in a music hall in East London. Appears to be just a studio set, but it's supposed to be in East London. And how do we know this? Because shots are fired inside the music hall. The crowd goes outside, and Hannay suddenly finds a mysterious woman by his side who tells him her name is Annabella Smith, but she's played by the German actress Lucy Mannheim. And she's obviously not quite who she's pretending to be. And she gets Hannay involved in the whole plot, basically, this meeting. And they get on a bus. And the bus they get on is a number 25A. And they get on the bus on the opposite side of the road to the theatre. And off it goes. So it's heading west. And indeed, Hitchcock would have been very familiar with the 25A because it was the route from the East End into central London. Certainly until recently, the number 25 was running from Ilford to Oxford Circus. And it makes perfect sense for Richard Hannay to be getting on that because he lives a little way up from Oxford Circus in a flat in Portland Place near the BBC. So it's a little detail that, as I say, that the people watching it on screen, it doesn't make any point at all. It's not necessary, but Hitchcock got the right bus for them to be getting on. I don't know if he intended the music hall to represent a particular music hall, but the one that was in the right location on the north side of the road and so on and on the bus route was the Mile End Empire, which is long gone. I could go on all day about Hitchcock. But in 1971, Hitchcock comes back to London to film Frenzy, which is his last film but one. And it's an extraordinary film. It's not a comfortable film. It's got a particularly vicious and distressing murder very early on. It's not the comparatively cosy Sunday afternoon viewing that a lot of Hitchcock's films can be. But it's a brilliant film with an amazing British cast. None of them were ever big international stars. It's got Barry Foster, John Finch, Anna Massey, Clive Swift, Billy Whitelaw, Bernard Cribbins playing a pub landlord, wonderful Bernard Cribbins. It's got kind of a bit of everybody in it. Alec McCowan and Michael Bates playing the two policemen. Barbara Lee Hunt, who is an early victim in it. And it's a wonderful film in another way, because for once, it all fits together on screen as it does on the ground or on a map. In other words, if a character turns a corner, the next shot picks them up around that corner. If they say they're going somewhere, yep, they go there. And Hitchcock and Anthony Schaffer, who wrote the screenplay, must have very carefully plotted out how this was all going to fit together. So often in film, a character turns a corner and they're several blocks away in a different street or in a different town. And it doesn't matter as long as the storytelling works up on the screen. But with Frenzy, it's a very rewarding film to follow in its footsteps because you can do it. You can follow the trail, for example, from the Bow Street Tavern, I think is its latest incarnation, but it was in the early 1970s and until fairly recently, it was the Globe pub on Bow Street. You can follow John Finch when he's been sacked for stealing spirits from the optics and he claims he was going to pay for them. And Bernard Cribbins takes a dim view of this and sacks him from his job behind the bar. And you can follow John Finch's progress as he walks round to Covent Garden Market, where his old chum Bob Rusk works at Hartlett's Fruit Dealers. Bob Rusk, played by the wonderful Barry Foster. And you can later follow the chilling progress of the serial killer's activities on Henrietta Street near Covent Garden Market. And I said Hitchcock continues to have these English influences and these London influences on his movies. And part of that is because he's such an avid theatre-goer. He and Alma go to the theatre a lot in the 1920s. And frequently there are people who were working in the London theatre in those days who turn up years and years later in a Hitchcock movie. A great example of that is Ethel Griffey's. If you've ever seen The Birds, the majority of the characters in it are American. But you remember the tweedy, eccentric, very, very English lady ornithologist who turns up? Well, that's Ethel Griffey's, who'd had a very, very long career. She was, I think, 82 or 83 when she made that movie. But she'd been in London since the beginning of the 20th century on stage and then worked in the States and then sort of semi-retired and done all kinds of stuff. But she's typical of one of those actors who Hitchcock probably saw in the 1920s. And those English influences carry on. And just as a final thought, Hitchcock lived through a sort of legendary period in terms of London's crime history. There was a lot of it that was covered in detail by the press. He's born, obviously, a decade after the Jack the Ripper murders, but Jack the Ripper was still a living legend, almost literally, in the East End when Hitchcock was a boy. So no wonder The Lodger, with its is this man or is he not a kind of Jack the Ripper figure, it's no wonder that appealed to him. But also, there was another crime, a very sensational one in 1910, the Crippen case, where Dr. Crippen murdered his wife in their house in Camden and fled with his secretary. It was a sensation at the time. And you might think, what on earth has that got to do with Hitchcock's movies? Well, it's all about the jewellery. And if you think about jewellery in Hitchcock's films, well, there's two that immediately spring to mind. One of them is Rear Window, where Grace Kelly finds the wedding ring that supposedly belongs to the wife who has gone out of town for a visit. And the other major piece of jewellery is the necklace that turns up in several places in Vertigo. And I can't really say any more about that in case you haven't seen the film, but essentially there's a point almost at the end where James Stewart sees the necklace in a place where it absolutely shouldn't be, and suddenly he understands what has happened for the first time. Well, that business of the jewellery turning up where it shouldn't turn up, and Hitchcock said this in interviews, was directly inspired by the Crippen case, because one of the things that had alerted people to the fact that perhaps Mrs. Crippen hadn't gone away and back to the States early in 1910 was that Crippen's pretty secretary, Ethel Leneve, had been seen wearing some of the wife's jewellery. And, tempted to quote from Vertigo that it was a bad idea. You shouldn't have worn it. You shouldn't have been so sentimental. Well, that's a little bit about Alfred Hitchcock and London. Believe me, that's just scratching the surface. But if you have time to spare to join one of the virtual tours, or hopefully, if I can bring Hitchcock back onto the streets where he belongs in London, I may have the pleasure of your company sometime. But for now, my name's Richard Burnip, and thank you for joining me.